In a world overflowing with noise, shallow takes an information that evaporates the moment you hear it. Selenius Media exists for one purpose: to give you depth. Whether the subject is philosophy, psychology, history, science, artificial intelligence, literature, or the shape of the future, every series we publish is built on one idea: that thinking clearly is a form of survival. Our catalog spans dozens of long-form, story-driven shows. From Western moral philosophy for beginners to pioneers of psychology and psychiatry, from AI and uncertain future to the classical music giants, each series is crafted to give you more than facts. It gives you the context, the conflict, and the human meaning behind the ideas that shaped our world. If you enjoy this program, explore the rest of our library. Every show is designed to stand alone, but together they form a larger project, a guided tour of the forces, intellectual, emotional, political, technological, that built the world we live in and the world we're about to enter. Visit the Selenius Media channel to discover new series, follow your favorites, and support the work that allows us to create long-form, high-fidelity, educational storytelling. And please leave comments if you enjoy our shows. Now let's begin. In the late 11th century, in a small monastery on the rocky coast of Normandy, a monk sits awake before dawn. The stone walls hold the night's cold. A single candle throws a small, trembling circle of light across his desk. On the table in front of him is a piece of parchment covered in neat Latin script, and near the top, one line that has begun to haunt him. It's a definition, really, a simple phrase about God. But the more he stares at it, the more he feels that if the phrase is taken seriously, it carries with it something shocking. The claim that from the mere idea of God, one can show that God must exist. This monk is Anselm of Bec, later Archbishop of Canterbury, and that line will become famous as the seed of the ontological argument. For Anselm himself, though, it is not a clever trick. It is a kind of prayer in the form of logic, a way of letting his mind move toward the God he already believes in. Anselm was born in 1033 in Aosta, a town nestled in the Alpine region that, at the time, belonged to the Kingdom of Burgundy. His family was relatively well off. His father, Gundulf, was a local nobleman known for his hot temper and worldly ambitions. His mother, Ermenberga, was pious and gentle, a stabilizing presence in the household. From her, Anselm absorbed a sense of reverence and affection for God. From his father, perhaps, he learned something about the dangers of pride and the volatility of power. As a boy, Anselm was bright, inquisitive, and restless. Stories from his early life are wrapped in the haze of later hagiography, but one in particular captures the tone of his imagination. He is said to have dreamt that he climbed a mountain and entered a heavenly court, where he spoke with God and was fed with divine bread. Whether this happened exactly as told is less important than the picture it gives. A child for whom thoughts of God were not abstract doctrines, but something like homesickness, a longing for a reality that felt more solid than the world around him. He wanted to become a monk as a teenager, but his father opposed the idea. For Gundulf, monastic life meant throwing away social position and worldly opportunity. He wanted his son to manage estates, inherit property, move in noble circles. The clash between them grew severe. Anselm's mother died. The household became more hostile. Eventually, Anselm did what many young people in crowded medieval households did when pressure grew unbearable. He left. Around the age of 23, he crossed the Alps into France with a companion, traveling through Burgundy and into Normandy. After a period of wandering, he arrived at the Benedictine Abbey of Bec, a rising center of learning and spirituality. There, he encountered Lanfranc, the prior and master of studies, whose reputation as a teacher had drawn students from across Europe. Bec offered Anselm something he had never quite had, a community ordered around prayer, study, and work, a rhythm of life that gave structure to his desire for God and his hunger for understanding. He entered the monastery as a novice around 1060 and took vows shortly after. In the cloister of Bec, Anselm's talent quickly became apparent. When Lanfranc left to become abbot of Caen and then Archbishop of Canterbury, Anselm was chosen as prior, and later as abbot. He taught younger monks, corresponded with students, and began to write. His works from this period are compact but dense: the Monologion, the Proslogion, Dialogues on Truth, Freedom, and the Fall of the Devil. He did not see himself as an innovator, but as a believer trying to understand what he had already received. The phrase he used for his approach has become emblematic of a whole strand of Christian thought: fides querens intellectum, faith seeking understanding. He did not set out to prove God to skeptics. He began from the stance of someone who already believes, who already prays. From there, he asked, if these things are true, what follows? How can they be seen more clearly? How far can the light of reason travel along the path faith has already opened? In the Monologion, he starts from the observation that we call many different things good, great, just, beautiful. Some acts are more just than others, some objects more beautiful, some people wiser. This more and less hints, he thinks, at a standard. When we say one act is better than another, we measure them implicitly against an idea of what would be best. He reasons that there must be something that is goodness itself, a highest good in which all lesser goods participate, a standard that is good not by comparison, but in itself. From there, he argues toward a single, supremely real source of all being and value, what he identifies with God. This is not yet the ontological argument that will make his name in the history of philosophy, but it already shows his method. He moves from ordinary moral judgments, this is more just than that, this love is nobler than that, to a metaphysical conclusion that there must be an ultimate ground for the hierarchy of goods we perceive. The Proslogion, written after the Monologion, is at once more personal and more audacious. It opens with a kind of exhortation to himself. Come now, little man, flee for a while your occupations. He urges his own mind to withdraw from distraction, to rest from anxiety, and to seek the face of God. He laments that he cannot see God as he longs to. Then he offers a single, focused definition. God is that than which nothing greater can be thought. From that definition, he constructs his famous argument. Even the fool who says in his heart, there is no God, quoting the Psalms, understands the phrase, that than which nothing greater can be thought. It exists in his understanding as a concept. The question is whether it exists only in the mind or also in reality. If it exists only in the mind, Anselm says, then we can conceive of something greater, the same being existing both in the mind and in reality. But if we can think of that greater, then the original that, than which nothing greater can be thought, was not truly the greatest conceivable. This is a contradiction. Therefore, the being that fits this definition must exist not only in the understanding, but also in reality. It is a startling move. Later philosophers will poke and prod it from every angle. Gaunolo, a contemporary monk, will respond with a parody, imagining an island than which no greater island can be conceived, and pointing out that defining such an island does not make it exist. Centuries later, Kant will argue that existence is not a predicate like red or tall that can be simply added to a concept. Modern logicians will reformulate and critique the argument in symbolic language. Yet despite all this, the argument refuses to die. It keeps surfacing in new clothes. For Anselm himself, the argument is less a knockdown proof than an attempt to trace in words a conviction already alive in his heart. That God is not a being alongside others, but the absolute limit of thought, the source of all gradations of greatness. If God is truly that than which nothing greater can be thought, then God cannot be confined to the status of an idea in our minds. The moral significance is subtle but important. The standard by which we judge goodness and greatness is not something we invent. It is something that, on his view, has its own independent reality. Anselm's life, however, does not remain confined to the quiet drama of prayer and logic. History pulls him into a larger stage. After the Norman conquest of England in 1066, Norman churchmen begin to take leading roles in the English church. Lanfranc becomes Archbishop of Canterbury, reforming monastic life and tightening discipline. When Lanfranc dies, King William II, William Rufus, keeps the See of Canterbury vacant for years, using its revenues for the crown. In 1093, When William falls gravely ill and fears for his soul, he suddenly decides to fill the vacancy. He chooses Anselm, whose reputation for holiness and learning has spread across the channel. Anselm does not want the job. Chroniclers tell us that he clings to the post of the altar, weeping, as others try to pull him away to invest him with the pastoral staff. Eventually, he submits, seeing in the unwanted burden a call from God. He becomes Archbishop of Canterbury and immediately finds himself in conflict with the king. The heart of the conflict is power. Who controls the church in England? Who has the authority to appoint bishops, invest them with their symbols of office, and demand their allegiance? The Norman kings expect bishops to be royal servants first, spiritual leaders second. Reformers within the church, part of a broader movement centered on Rome, argue that bishops serve God first and must be free from worldly domination in spiritual matters. The conflict that erupts over lay investiture is not a technical quarrel. It is a struggle over whether conscience and doctrine can have a degree of independence from political interests. Anselm sides firmly with the Reform Party. He insists that he owes loyalty to the king in temporal matters, but that he must look to the Pope in spiritual ones. William wants him to refuse a pallium, a sign of archiepiscopal authority, sent from Rome unless William grants permission. Anselm refuses. Tension escalates. Eventually, Anselm is exiled. He spends years in Italy and at the papal court, writing and advising, longing for the peace of monastic life that has been taken from him. When William dies and Henry I becomes king, Anselm returns, hoping for a better relationship. But the conflict flares again over investiture. Henry wants the right to invest bishops with ring and staff, symbols of spiritual office. Anselm, following papal decrees, refuses to allow it. Again, there are negotiations, threats, exiles, reluctant compromises. Finally, a settlement is reached. The king will no longer invest with spiritual symbols, but will still have a role in nominating bishops and receiving their homage in temporal matters. From a distance, this can look like arcane medieval politics, but morally, it sets a pattern that will echo through later Western history. The idea that there are spheres of life, conscience, doctrine, sacramental ministry, that should not be simply absorbed by the state. Anselm is not a modern secularist. He believes in a Christian society, but he resists the reduction of the church to a department of royal administration. That resistance, rooted in his sense of truth and justice, costs him years of exile and stress. Back in his study, away from the courts and councils, Anselm continues to think about the internal structure of moral life. One of his most important works in this area is Cur Deus Homo, Why God Became Human. He frames it as a dialogue with a curious interlocutor, Boso, who asks, why was the incarnation necessary? Could God not simply forgive sins by sheer will? Anselm's answer is built around the notions of honor, debt, and satisfaction, drawn from his feudal context, but deployed in a carefully argued way. Sin, he says, is not only disobedience, it is a failure to render to God what is due, the full love and obedience of a rational creature. This creates a kind of moral debt. Justice requires that this debt be addressed. But humans, already owing everything to God, cannot pay extra, as it were. We cannot offer something beyond what is already due, nor can God simply ignore the debt, because that would make light of the moral order. So the one who makes satisfaction must be both God and human. Human, to represent us. Divine, to offer something of infinite worth. In Christ, Anselm says, God becomes human, lives in perfect obedience, and in his death offers a superabundant satisfaction that restores the balance. Later generations will argue about this. Is it too bound to feudal ideas of honor? Does it make God dependent on payment? Critics will see in it a harsh image of divine justice. Defenders will argue that Anselm is, in fact, trying to demonstrate how mercy and justice are both honored. The seriousness of sin is acknowledged. Its consequences are not denied. But God, rather than demanding that humans pay, steps in to bear the cost himself. For moral philosophy, The important point is that wrongdoing is taken seriously. It is not something that can be erased by a mere divine shrug or by the sinner's feeling of regret. Evil has an objective dimension. It distorts relationships and creates obligations. Any adequate account of forgiveness has to face that. Anselm is one of the first in the Latin West to lay out a careful, if controversial, structure for how this might work. In other works, he turns to the nature of truth and freedom. In his Dialogue on Truth, he asks what it means for a statement, or a will, or an action to be true. Truth, he concludes, consists in rectitude, in being as it ought to be, held for its own sake. A proposition is true when it signifies what is. A will is true when it wills what ought to be willed, because it ought to be so, not just for some ulterior motive. This idea of rectitude links epistemology and ethics. Truth is not just a matter of accurate description, but of an inner alignment between thought, will, and reality. In On Freedom of Choice, he distinguishes between different senses of necessity and possibility. Freedom, he says, is not the mere power to do otherwise. It is the power to preserve rectitude for its own sake. A will is free when it is able to cling to justice, not out of fear or compulsion, but because it recognizes justice as fitting and loves it. Before sin, he imagines, rational creatures had the freedom either to keep rectitude or to abandon it. After sin, our freedom is damaged. We can still choose in many domains, what to eat, where to walk, what to say. But our ability to choose the highest good purely for its own sake is compromised. Grace is what heals that capacity, making true freedom possible again. That way of thinking about freedom, as ordered to the good and damaged by sin, will echo strongly in later centuries. It stands in sharp contrast to modern notions that equate freedom with neutrality or with the absence of any intrinsic orientation. For Anselm, a will that cannot cling to the good is not more free. It is less so. The addict who cannot choose sobriety, even when he wants it, is not the paradigm of freedom. The saint who cannot be bribed or threatened into injustice, whose will is fixed on the good, is closer to the fullest freedom. In the treatise On the Fall of the Devil, Anselm speculates about why some angels fell and others remained faithful. It may seem remote, but again, he is probing a central moral question. How can a rational being, seeing the good, choose against it? His answer hinges on pride. The fallen angel, he suggests, desired a kind of equality with God not offered to him. He wanted an excellence that was not appropriate to his nature. Instead of rejoicing in the rectitude given him, he grasped for more. Sin, then, is not the love of evil as such. It is a disordered love of some lesser good, power, independence, glory, in a way that breaks its proper relation to the highest good. That structure, sin as disordered love, is very close to Augustine's, but Anselm gives it a slightly more juridical, analytic shape. Pride is not just a feeling. It is a misjudgment and a mischoice. It treats what is finite as if it were infinite, and what is derived as if it were self-originating. Again, there are echoes here that will carry all the way into modern discussions of narcissism, autonomy, and the limits of self-assertion. If you want to feel Anselm's moral world from the inside, you can turn to his Prayers and Meditations. These are not treatises, but addresses to God and to saints, written for private use. They are intense, sometimes almost raw. He dwells on the sufferings of Christ, on the wounds, the blood, the humiliation, and sees in them both the horror of sin and the depth of divine love. He speaks of himself as unworthy, cold, distracted, yet appeals constantly to mercy. It can sound, to modern ears, like spiritual self-abasement. But within his framework, it is an attempt to strip away self-deception. He believes that only when we see clearly our own weakness and mixed motives can we appreciate the gift that grace represents. At the same time, he has a robust sense of human dignity. Rational creatures, for him, are made to participate in the highest good. They are capable of knowing and loving God. That is an astonishing elevation The tragedy of sin is precisely that it diverts a nature designed for joy into petty projects. His sharp language about unworthiness is not a denial of value. It is a protest against wasted possibility. When Anselm dies in 1109 in Canterbury, he leaves behind a church still struggling with kings, a set of books that will circulate among scholars, and a reputation for sanctity that will lead to his canonization a century later. In a long story of Western moral philosophy, he stands at a hinge point. Behind him lie the church fathers, especially Augustine, with their rich but less systematically organized reflections on will, love, and grace. Ahead of him lie the great scholastics, who will build elaborate systems. Anselm is one of the first to show how you can take the tools of logic and decloy them rigorously inside a life of prayer and ecclesial struggle. For your listeners, the value of Anselm is not just in the ontological argument that philosophy textbooks summarize. It is in the picture of a human being trying to hold together several convictions at once, that God is the ultimate standard of goodness and greatness, that reason, used honestly, can illuminate what faith confesses, that moral life is about the rectitude of the will, its alignment with justice and love, rather than mere external compliance. And that freedom reaches its peak not in limitless options, but in an unshakable orientation toward the good. Imagine him once more in that early morning at Beck. The candle is burning low. Outside, the first hint of light is touching the horizon. In a few minutes, the bell will ring and the community will gather for prayer. Anselm has been struggling all night with that definition, that than which nothing greater can be thought, and its consequences. When he finally lays down his pen, he is not triumphantly proving something to an opponent. He is, in his own eyes, tracing the outline of the one he has been seeking since childhood, the one who, he believes, has given him the capacity to think and to love in the first place. The argument is ink on parchment. The moral life that flows from it, a life of worship, justice, resistance to unjust power, and a restless search for understanding, is the real testimony he leaves behind.
Midnight rails under silver moon, dusty boots on a winding road. A shadow's the only friend I've known since she packed up and let me go. Empty whiskey bottle on the sea, her laugh still echoes in my bones. Saddle's heavy with memories. I ride alone where the wind still blows. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. Some soul, every town I pass feels half her size. Every trail's haunted by goodbye. I whisper prayers to open skies, hoping someday my heart'll find a brand new path beyond the pain where broken hearts can heal in time. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere. else to be.